I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation is what we do with global attitude. This round is with Dan Ariely, the behavioral economist, using the new name for market psychologist. But Dan Ariely and his surprise bestseller, Predictably Irrational, are about much more than marketing. They demonstrate how often, how depressingly regularly, we don't know what we're choosing and we don't get what we want, whether we're shopping or loving or making public decisions about war and peace. The lure of Dan Ariely's work and his webpage and his conversation is a genius for small social experiments with beer tastings and basketball tickets, as you'll hear. This conversation was on the Boston Fish Pier, and it started with the simple stuff before heading for the deep water.
I get emails and calls from all kinds of people to talk about all kinds of things, starting from kids' education to crime to obesity. So I've actually met with quite a few obesity groups. And, you know, obesity is a huge problem, of course, and nobody has any clue about how to solve it. In fact, they told me that one of the big mysteries is not why we're fat, but how come we're so thin? Because each of us is eating about 200, 300, 400 calories more than we would have eaten 40 years ago. The question is, where is this going to? We don't exercise more. We don't walk more. So the big riddle is not on the obese people. It's on the non-obese people. How come we're not obese? But one of the problems is that people eat too fast. Because you know that you are satiated only about 20 minutes after you've finished eating. So if you can slow it down, you will eat less between the time you are had enough and you know you're enough. So chopsticks, for example, are a good idea. Now, if you use the Chinese method and you just shove it all in, it's not helping. But imagine you took it to a designer and you say, we want a design challenge of saying, how would you start from scratch designing plates, forks, knives, spoons to slow people down? What would it look like? What would it be? And would it have an effect on people? We're planning now another program, which I'm very curious about, building on the idea of psychology of waste. So people hate wasting, right? It feels very bad to waste. So the question is, can you coerce psychology of wasting and to get people to eat more vegetables? So the idea is to get people to commit to getting a box of vegetables every week delivered to them. Now, if it's coming every Monday, a box of vegetables, it means that the vegetables you haven't finished eating are going to waste. Now, on top of that, if you would give people a list of saying what vegetables would go to waste every day, and if we would give them a little bit too much vegetables, right, more than they planned, the question is, will those vegetables start substituting other things? So there's a whole interesting area kind of linking between public policy and commerce, which says, how can we link different psychological deficits that we have and harness them for good behavior? And the psychology of waste could be one of those that could actually get us to eat more vegetables.
Dan Ariely, the joy and maybe the genius of your work is this business of very, what seems simple experiments that turn into public parables. The power of zero, for example, or power of free, second pair of socks free, etc. Why don't we make registrations for hybrid cars free? Or using the deadlines for semester papers in an MIT class becomes a parable of how health testing, for example, should be packaged and bundled, and how much authoritarianism, how much incentive, how much freedom, how much coercion, etc., works. Give an example of what you're working on right now. I want to follow you into these public choices, political choices that the country is making all the time. A lot of them wrong. A lot of them irrational, shall we say.
So one thing is, you know, I'm very happy that you are willing to kind of jump with me and take these experiments and saying, what does it really mean about a deep psychological aspect of human behavior and how it could be translated into all of these domains? Yeah. And I think in many ways, this is the fun thing about social science, is you isolate a particular fact, factor, idea, a metaphor for how we work in a certain domain, and then you say, if this is how we work, this is how we work in a lot of domains, and this is one of the things we can learn about it. And partially this is the real fun of the profession, is to understand that you can take anything in life. You can take some chocolates and you can take a beer and you can study something about deeply about how we behave. And then you can start making the connections between that and other behaviors in other domains. So you asked me, what am I working on now? So, you know, I have many projects all the time. I'll tell you one of the most strange ones. So I don't know, do you ever argue with your wife?
It's been known to happen, yeah.
So arguments are kind of interesting because somebody is going to lose at some point, let's say most arguments. One person will be kind of the winner, one person will be the loser in some general sense. And the process of argument is one that nobody enjoys. So I wanted to look at this. And what we're going to basically do is we found this game based on a chicken game. You know, the chicken game used to be one where two people would drive across from each other and the question is who will veer off the course first. Well, this game has two metal rods that start giving you electrical shock. And the electrical shock increases every second. And the loser is the first person to give up. Okay, now you can see why this is an analogy for an argument. You suffer as you threw it, and the question is who would give up first. So what we are planning to do is to bring couples who are currently dating and couples who recently broke up. And we want to put them through this test. And we want to understand what is it about couples that would get them to sustain longer through this painful process. Who will be the one that will give up? What will promote it? So we're trying to look at this electrical shock as a metaphor for arguments and trying to understand how do these arguments really resolve and who gives up. And who continues in too long?
And how does it lead to peace? Or how does it lead to something other than endless argument? We tell newlyweds now, the most important phrase you have to remember is, you're right, right? You're right, sweetie, you're right.
Yeah, it turns out clinical psychologists used to tell people to say, I hear you. And they recently switched from I hear you to you're right. But I think it's actually very important to say about how do we move that to solving something. And the question is, who would give up first? And the process of the argument is painful for everybody. So the moment we can understand about what are the characteristics that limit this amount of time spent in this game being electrified, we can actually start to understand what could reduce electrical shocks. But going back to peace, let me give you a story about beer and vinegar and how I think it relates to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah, please.
So we did these very simple experiments at the bar at MIT, where we gave people two beers. One was regular beer, either Budweiser or Sam Adams, and one was the same beer, but with balsamic vinegar. And it turns out that when we don't tell people about it, and we say, here are two glasses of beer, try them out and tell us which one you want a full glass of, the vast majority prefer the one with balsamic vinegar. I don't know why it happened, it just turns out that balsamic vinegar adds quality to the beer for most of our people. When we tell them about it up front, we say, here are two beers, one with balsamic, one without, taste them and tell us which one you want a full glass of, they hate the one with balsamic vinegar. In fact, it doesn't matter how much they taste it, they always hate it. Now this basically tells you that your expectations about something being disgusting cannot be corrected by experience. That rather than being changed by the experience, it succumbed to the experience. And you expect it to be terrible, and you taste it as terrible. Now, this is basically an idea of how reality that we end up experiencing is partially based on reality, but partially based on our expectations. Now, let's go to the Israeli-Palestinian issues. Now, I'm Israeli, of course, by my accent, you can tell. Here we have two people, nations, who've been fighting for a long time. And each side has their own preconception. And the fact is that I don't think you can have a single event out there in the world and to have both parties agree to what's the reality.
Yeah.
Right? You can have a bus exploded, a missile, an attack, whatever happens, you would have an Israeli version, a Palestinian version. And for me as an Israeli, as left-wing as I am, I will not be able to see it from the eyes of a Palestinian. I just don't have that historical perspective. So what do you do? What do you do if you believe that our reality that we end up experiencing is based on our preconceptions, and our preconceptions are different? So we can never agree on what's reality. We can never agree on what's a just solution, because justice for us seems so very different. And my personal understanding is that we have to do two things. We have to recognize our bias, And therefore, we have to assume that we can't just solve it. And therefore, we have to get a third party to help us get into a solution. Because left to our own accord, we are always left with vinegar. And we have one version of vinegar, and they have the other version of vinegar, and we'll never really agree on the facts. And everything escalates. One side attacks, the other person sees them being attacked, and they try to revenge, and they try to revenge. And in some sense, it doesn't matter who started, and it doesn't matter who's at fault. This is all in the eye of the beholder. Can we move forward? I think it'll be very hard to move forward if we rely on our own basic intuition of what's right and what's wrong, and that's what we're trying to optimize.
There's so many ways that your research begs to be applied. For example, you write about this decoy effect. If you're trying to impress a woman, take somebody with you who's a lot like you, but not quite as keen or something. But draw the comparison. In presidential politics this year, they say the mantra is change. So then the question becomes, is Barack the first black candidate or Hillary the first female candidate to make it this far, the decoy? And which one do we go for instead of the other? Do you see that kind of thing working in our presidential choices?
Yeah, very much. So let's think for a second about what's the fundamentals. The fundamental is that we have a very hard time evaluating things in absolute way. How attractive are you in absolute ways? Hard to tell, but if I found somebody else that looks like you but less attractive, you would look good in comparison. How much fun, how much utility are we really getting from a piece of chocolate, from a cup of coffee? We don't know, but when we see it compared to something else, it's easy. Now, because we have a hard time understanding things in absolute way, we can fall into all kinds of traps. So one of the examples I like is, imagine you had a choice between a weekend in Rome, all expenses paid, or a weekend in Paris, all expenses paid. Now, these are very different things, right? Different culture, different food, different romance, different art. Hard to choose between them. Now imagine I add another option. A weekend in Rome, all expenses paid, with the exception that you don't get coffee in the morning. Now, that's not an exciting offer, right? But what it does, it makes Rome with coffee looks more attractive. And it turns out that adding to the Rome and Paris options, the Rome without coffee option, makes Rome looks better, not just relative to Rome without coffee. It makes it look better overall, even compared to Paris. Now, that's an amazing idea, that you can add something that nobody wants, but nevertheless will change how we view the other options and what you end up choosing. Now, let's talk about politics. For a long time, I thought that Hillary's suggestion of the Hillary plus Obama ticket made the Hillary-only ticket like a decoy. Because all of a sudden, you had Obama, you had Hillary, and you had Hillary plus Obama. Now, Hillary plus Obama looked like the Rome with coffee, and next to it, Hillary without Obama looked like the Rome without coffee. Now, Obama, on his part, could have said, yes, I'll take that. And if he would have, I think that ticket would have won. But by making that option not available, he made the Hillary option look worse. So in the same way that Rome without coffee makes the Rome with coffee looks better, the Rome with coffee makes the Rome without coffee looks worse. So the Hillary and Obama tickets looked relatively better than the Hillary ticket, but it also made the Hillary alone ticket look much, much worse. So I do think there's all kinds of relative evaluation. I'll give you two more examples for this. So McCain is basically trying to say that Obama has no experience. Right? Now, we can argue what experience they both have, but let's assume for now that McCain has more experience in the military domain than Obama. If you just look at it this way, it looks that McCain has more experience than Obama because he does have it, and you focus on the relative evaluation. But now let's assume that you don't focus on that, you focus on their overall experience, and you say, who of them has experience in getting us out of a war? Nobody. Which of them have experience in getting it out of the social security problem we have right now? None of them, of course. Who of them has any experience in healthcare, which is one of the huge issues facing this country? All of a sudden you say, well, in fact, none of them have almost any relevant experience. It's true that on this dimension of experience, McCain might be slightly better than Obama, but they're both so low in experience that almost none of them have relevant experience. Now, this is basically a framing. Obama wants to say, look, we have no experience, relevant experience, and what you need to do is to trust that somebody has a good judgment, the interest of the public, and they're truthful and honest and want to work on that, whereas McCain wants to focus on the difference between them. So that's a second way in which politics is very much like products and like everything else we make decision about. I'll tell you another thing which actually kind of worries me about Obama. We wrote a paper about a year ago on online dating. And what we basically found was that when people in online dating describe themselves in vaguer terms, less precise terms, they are more popular. And the reason is that when you are vague, everybody can read into them what they want. So imagine you go on an online dating site and you describe yourself and you say you like music. It turns out everybody thinks you like the music that they like. So vague terms help everybody see what they want to see in your reflection, and this similarity breeds liking. So that's one thing, is vagueness translating to liking. It turns out the same thing happens with pictures, by the way. You put pictures that are slightly more fuzzy, people think you're more attractive. But here is the second thing we discovered, is that people get crushed when they meet for coffee. So they read somebody's profile online, they create all these high expectations, and then they meet for coffee and they get crushed. Now, this is where I think the analogy for Obama fits very well, but also the danger for Obama. So I think Obama is more vague than Hillary in the sense that we know less about exactly where he stands on multiple issues. We have less history with him and so on. And even if it's not real, I think that's the feeling that the people have. Because of that, I think people can read into Obama what they want, which is one of his appeals. And at the same time, I also think we will have coffee with Obama at some point. And the only question is, has always been, when will we have coffee with Obama? Will we have coffee with Obama before the Democratic nomination, which obviously didn't happen? Or will we have it between now and the general election? Or will we have it after the general election? Now, the truth is that no human being can stand to the expectations the public have from Obama. I mean, they're just really unrealistic expectations. I have unrealistic expectations from him as well. So at some point, we'll get disappointed. The question is, how much and when?
From the predictably irrational standpoint, how did Obama win the choice of the two changes? Should we go first female or should we go first African-American?
I don't know if that was on people's mindset is this comparison. I agree, it was a very interesting time to have this comparison. I think Hillary, you know, was carrying out a lot of baggage with her. She was a very difficult candidate. Obama kept on saying change to a country that really wants dramatically change, and I think he just had a more appealing message. But if you look at it actually carefully, I think that his big advantage happened earlier rather than later. So basically up to about the middle of February, his appeal over Hillary was much higher than after the middle of February. And I think I worry that this is a trend that will continue. Now, think about it from the perspective of vagueness. If you were the Republicans now and you had 6 months of propaganda to do, there's a lot of time for somebody like Obama. I mean, Hillary have been dragged through the trash, through the mud, I guess is the expression, for many years. It's hard to think that we would reveal more negative stuff about her. And I worry that with Obama, we will reveal more negative stuff, and that would actually create some disenchantment. And in some sense, one of the things I was thinking about is whether he should be upfront, get us disenchanted now and give us 5 months to get over it, or should it trickle in over time as newspapers and the Republicans drag him to the mud? I'm not sure what's the right approach.
Think of it in terms of some of the policy choices, specifically war. For example, war with Iran or an attack on Iran. I see a certain decoy thing going here, or comparative shopping or pricing thing, because the line is, we wouldn't invade Iran, we'd just smash them with some bombing. How do the war issues, judgment on Iraq, the question of attacking Iran, how do these things play in the predictably irrational scope?
So in some sense, I think that the war in Iraq, because of its incredible magnitude, both in terms of life lost, duration, type of invasion, cost of in human lives, and financial, has created a whole new standard for what America can do in a war. So if we wanted now to invade some new country, it will be looked at as a background of the Iraq war. Saying, my goodness, you're only spending $80 million on this. It's $1 billion on this. It sounds like a steal, right? Cheap. There's a sale on invasions. Whereas I think that before this catastrophe, any invasion would have looked at with much more severity. But yeah, we've kind of immunized ourselves. We've given ourselves a standard of invasion that has been incredible in magnitude, and everything will be compared relative to it. Right. And you know, I'm hoping that nothing ever will become at this magnitude again.
This is the $1.75 cup of coffee. I mean, we've set a new price point for coffee and for wars. A lot of people, including me, would say that war by now has become irrational in itself. The cost is always so devastating by any measure. How do you see that irrational choice being made over and over again and being reconsidered even now, say with Iran, both by Israel and the United States?
So I think there are two principles of irrationality that fit well into here. One is what we call sunk cost, or the sunk cost fallacy. And I'll give you the following example. Imagine that you're designing a new car, and this car was going to cost you $100 million to design, and you already invested $95 million, 95% of this amount. And yesterday you learned that one of your competitors has just come out with a better car, similar to yours, but more energy efficient, less polluting, and so on. Would you go and spend the last $5 million to finish the design? Now, compare that to another situation in which you haven't designed any car yet, and designing a new car will cost you $5 million. But yesterday you learned that your competitor just came out with a better car. Now, what people do in this answer is they say, well, if I spend $95 million, I'll spend the last $5 million. But if they didn't spend anything, they will not go ahead and spend the next $5 million. You see, what happened is that every time you make a decision, you should just look at the future. You say, from this point on, is it worthwhile to spend another $5 million? Is it profitable or not? What you spend in the past is money lost under the bridge. It's too late. You can't change anything about it. But people don't think this way. By the way, the same thing happened in the stock market. You can have a stock that you bought at a high price, and now it's gone down. It's very painful to sell it. So you keep on holding it and just hoping that it will go up at some point. Now, you should really think yourself, would I have bought this stock at this price? Is it going up in the future or down in the future? But that's not how we think. Now, the war is very much like that. And it turns out that the bigger, more effortful thing you've done, the more attached you feel to it. And partially it's regret. It's, if we've invested $400 billion into a war and we will just leave it as it is and it hasn't achieved anything, we would feel like it's a real waste. So what do? We keep on investing more and more and more in the hope that would achieve something in the future. That's one of the principles. The second principle, I think, is relevant, has to do with what Festinger many years ago called cognitive dissonance. And many people know the term, of course. And the basic idea of cognitive dissonance is that if you get people to do something that they don't really like, they change their opinion and they start liking it more. And here is what Festinger did. He basically got people to do a very boring task of screwing bolts into a board. And some people got paid handsomely for it, $20, and some people did not get paid well at all. They got paid $1. And then the question is, who would like this task more? Who would recommend it more to their friends? Now, if you did a boring task and you got paid $20, there's no problem. There's no dissonance. But if you did a boring task and you got paid very little for it, there's a dissonance. You say, what was I thinking? How could it be that I did this boring task for $1? And you can't change the fact you've done this task. You know you've done the task for $1. So what you change is how much you like it. So say, oh, I must have liked it more. You see, our actions are unchangeable, but our beliefs are much more fluid. So it turns out that the people who got paid $1 reporting to like the task much more, recommended to their friends much more, and so on. It turns out that if you do a really big investment in something, you change your beliefs to fit with this behavior. So now we've committed an incredible amount of behavior to this. It's not like in Festinger we did the 1 hour of drilling things in a slightly boring task. We've been spending years, lives, money, resources into this task. And as a consequence, we end up liking, changing our opinion about the war just a little bit too much. Now, I'm not saying everybody's doing it and everybody's doing it a lot, but there is this force that makes us to feel that we've invested all this. Therefore, we feel the need to actually justify it more and like it, or, you know, in some sense, be less aversive to it.
This sounds like your experiment with the Duke kids who had won their basketball tickets, the Final Four tickets in a lottery, and once they got them, nothing would induce them to part with them. We love what we have, and we stick with what we're doing. We're, in that sense, very, very conservative beings. So, Dan Ariely, how do we get out of this war habit? That seems to me one of the fundamental questions for all of us in the world, but even in our 2008 voting choices. How do we break this momentum?
Yeah, you know, this is about getting attached to path courses of actions. And what we should be asking ourselves is if we did not have the war going up until now, and today we would have a decision of whether we want to invade Iraq in the way that the war would look tomorrow, would we have done it? And I think if we erase the past, nobody would say, yes, let's go ahead with it from today and on. But because we have this incredible history, we have a very hard time giving it up. Now, how do we change it? You know, I think that there are some things about human irrationality that we can't change. And I'll give you the most... this is kind of an extreme and strange example about attachment, but think about your kids. Okay, and imagine I asked you, how much would you sell me your kids? Like, how much all your memories and appreciation of them and those? How much money would I need to compensate you to make up for the loss of these emotions and so on? On most days, you would probably want a lot of money for the exchange. But imagine they were not your kids. When you just happened to meet them one day in the playground and you played with them and you learned about them and you liked them as much as you like your kids now, and their parents said, you know what, they're for sale. How much would you offer for them? I mean, you wouldn't offer that much for the kids, because it turns out the kids are not so much about what they are, but about the fact that they're ours. By the way, my kids are 2 and 5, so they're too young to listen to this and figure out what I think about kids. And of course, I do love them, but it is about the fact that they're ours, and the fact that they're ours make them very, very special. In the same way that in the Duke basketball tickets, what we saw was that people who stood in line for a week basically to get basketball tickets, there was a lottery and some people got it and some people didn't get it. They all really, really wanted it. It turns out that the moment somebody got a ticket and somebody didn't, a chasm appeared between them and they became different people. The people who had basketball tickets thought of them as the most wonderful thing in life. They thought they would tell their children and grandchildren about it.
Yeah.
It will be a defining moment of their life at Duke, and they did not want to part with these tickets even for $2,400.
And there was no price point in the middle where people without them could make a deal with the ones that had them.
That's right. The people who didn't have them didn't see the excitement about tickets. I mean, these are people who just finished standing a week in line, but all of a sudden they just didn't get them and they didn't feel that attached to them. Yeah, I can watch it in the bar, I can buy shoes, and they're only willing to spend $170. So nobody ever made a trade. Now, this basically tells you how deep is our attachment process. And, you know, we can speculate evolutionary how much it makes sense. You do want a mechanism to get us attached to our kids and family and community and ideology. But it turns out it's a very strong force, and even when we adapt a wrong path, we have a very hard time overcoming this. And this is the place where you can actually think about what is the role of democracy as reflecting people's yes. opinions versus reflecting people's best interests.
Yeah.
If we have people who are, let's just make some, extremely attached to the war in Iraq, but if the cord would sever, in 2 months they would not be attached anymore and would not get used to it. People, I don't think, are able to predict how quickly they would get over this feeling of complete waste of this war. Right now, people are thinking if we stop it right now, it would all have been for nothing. In how long will they get used to the fact that it would all have been for nothing? I think much shorter than they would have guessed. And it's a real dilemma for a politician about who you're serving. The people of the moment who think that they will feel that it's all gone to waste, or the people in 2 months who would be relieved that the war is over.
Dan Ariely, I'd like to. My last question would be simply: you demonstrate clearly that we're not rational human beings, weighing costs and benefits coolly. I would settle though for just restoring a pragmatic standard of public policy. Is it working? Is public education producing, you know, capable kids? Is a war or diplomatic strategy getting the results we thought we wanted? How do we go about restoring a does it work kind of standard?
So I have a very simple answer as a scientist. This is all about experiments. So if you think about behavioral economics, there are a few important lessons. The first one is that we're irrational sometimes, often maybe. The second one is that our intuitions are not always correct. Now, what do you do if you're wrong and you have bad intuitions? It means you need to test things. You can't trust your intuitions. Now, a useful analogy I find with the medical profession and the FDA. So until not too long ago, medical profession was awful, right? We had these treatments of leeches and bleeding people and all kinds of things that actually killed many people faster. But here's the issue. If you were a physician and you believe that leeches are working, you would never have the guts to deprive half of your patients from it just to see if it's working. You would have an intuition and you would apply it. In the same way that when we applied the No Child Left Behind policy, people had an intuition about what will be a good incentive structure and they apply it all over the board. Now, or another example, we just gave a tax rebate worth $153 billion to the American public. We had an intuition that it doesn't matter how we give that money, and we applied it over the board. The moment you understand to doubt your intuitions and to marry it with some irrational tendency, it means you need to start experimenting. Now, in the medical field, thank God, we have the FDA. Now, the FDA is not perfect. We all know it. But they're doing a great job in forcing people to do experiments. And by forcing people to do experiments, we can separate what is working and what is not working. And even with the FDA, it's quite difficult to do. I think we need similar discipline in policy. We actually need to mandate that every policy that goes on test something out, you know, take a little state, maybe Rhode Island, and check things out to see if they're working or not working. Before you give a $153 billion tax return, give tax return just to the people in Rhode Island and see what do they spend the money on, how does it work. Before you implement something like No Child Left Behind policy all over the place, do it in a few districts and check it out. The other thing that is kind of puzzling for me is that, you know, when we come to the physical world, when we design the physical world, we understand people's limitations. We make shoes for real people. We make utensils for real people. We make books for people and chairs and so on. We understand what we're good at, what we're not, what our body can do and what it can't achieve. When it comes to products of the mind, which where policy resides, we somehow assume that people are supermen of the mind, that they're all capable, right? What if we're not? What behavioral economics is showing is that in the same way we have physical limitations, we have cognitive limitations. Once you understand those cognitive limitations, you can actually think about how do we design better policies to fit with people's difficulty. And I'll give you just one simple example. Think about the subprime mortgage crisis.
Yeah.
So in a rational world, people would be able to calculate everything and pursue their best interests. But think about how a difficult decision it is to figure out how much mortgage you should be taking. Think for yourself. Imagine tomorrow you're moving to a new house. How much money should you spend on a house, and how much of it should you take as a mortgage? What an incredibly difficult computation to make. So what do people do instead? They go to the bank, and the bank says, I'll lend you 30% of your income. People said, okay. Now, this is not the right question, not the right answer. You should ask, how much should I borrow? Not how much would you lend me? But because it's so hard to figure out how much I should borrow, how much I, as Dan, an individual, should take as a risk, I take what the bank answer is, how much risk they're willing to take on me. So then we borrow too much. Now, if you understand where people can fail, you want to create a system that protects people from failing this way. So you want to understand that 228 are a really bad thing that you should not allow. And you want to understand that interest-only mortgages are also very dangerous. And maybe if you want to go even a step further and create a mortgage calculator that not only tells people what they can borrow, but it tells them what they should be borrowing, helps them analyze the risk and the decision and size of house that they want, and help them reason better about this very, very complex decision. I think if we took these lessons and we say, let's take the individual citizen perspective and let's help them optimize and understand that people can pursue their best interest only if they know what it is. So let's help them figure out what it is. We could actually have a whole new domain of public policy, but also leading us to a much healthier society.
Dan Ariely, your book helps enormously. I'm rethinking everything. And I'm so pleased to hear you on Open Source. This has been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's been very nice talking to you.